safe and stay tuned.
Good morning. You're tuned to KMUD Garberville 91.1 FM and HD1, KMUE Eureka 88.1 FM and HD1, KLAI Laytonville 90.3 FM. We're on the World Wide Web, KMUD.org, and out in Shelter Cove at 99.5 on translator K258BQ. It's time for Heroes and Patriots.
You investors in hate, you Saddams and you Bushes, you Bin Ladens and snakes, you billionaire bullies, you a globalized curse. You put war on the masses and then you clean out the purse. And that's how it's done.
Thank you for tuning in to Heroes and Patriots, a program about national security, intelligence, and foreign policy. Today is Thursday, February 3rd, 2022, and we are coming to you live from the studios of KMUD Community Radio in Northern California. I'm Mary Massey with co-host John Sakowitz. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mary, and good morning to our audience here and listening to the broadcast in Northern California and listening to the web stream throughout the country and the world. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting your community radio station, KMUD Radio.
Today's program and all programs will be archived here at KMUD.org, along with our program website, heroespatriots.org. We invite you as listeners to call in with questions for our guest today, 707-923-3911. Please be brief as you ask your question. Dennis Mayer is sitting in as our engineer this morning. Thank you, Dennis. And views and opinions expressed during this program do not necessarily reflect those of the board, staff, volunteers, or members of KMUD Community Radio. John, several of our past programs have focused on the concept of a shadow government, the military-industrial congressional complex, and governmental conspiracies. Today, we look at one such conspiracy that came to the surface as Sirhan Sirhan, the convicted assassin of Robert F. Kennedy in June 68, was again denied parole in January 2022, which is last month. This, despite his own son, Robert Jr., calling for Sirhan to be paroled, saying, "Sirhan did not kill my father." We have two knowledgeable guests about this conspiracy. In the first 30 minutes, we are joined by Lisa Pease, followed by attorney Denise Bowden in our second segment. So let's get started. Lisa Pease has been investigating the covert history of our country with a focus on the assassination of the 60s for 30 years. She is featured in Oliver Stone's documentary on JFK assassination called JFK Revisited, which we've talked about on this program. She has appeared on the Discovery Channel and various news broadcasts and radio stations. Her latest book, A Lie Too Big to Fail, The Real History of the Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. It was written up by the Washington Post, and a talk she gave on the subject was shown on C-SPAN's, American History Channel. Ms. Pease is also a contributor and co-editor of an anthology of essays called The Assassinations, Probe Magazine, JFK.
I am. I just had to hang up my phone because you were calling both. Okay.
Okay. So the last thing I was saying is she's written an anthology of essays for The Assassinations, Probe Magazine on JFK, MLK, RFK, and Malcolm X. Lisa Pease, welcome to the program. We know you're there.
Sorry about that. I'm here. Thank you for having me. And thank you for doing what you're doing, because most people, you know, just believe CNN and MSNBC and Fox or whatever they're watching, and they don't question whether that's reality. And right. History has shown that most of what goes on is not reported accurately at the time it's happening, and often never after.
In your anthology, I want to start with a broader question. The anthology for Probe Magazine, you list the four leaders that I mentioned, JFK, MLK, RFK, and Malcolm X, who are leaders, activists, intuitive men who were able to activate the minds and hearts of our nation. What Yes. made these four men, let's say as a group, a threat, and who in particular saw them as a threat?
Okay, great question. It's obvious to me after years of research and 30 years of research we're talking, all of them were a threat because all of them espoused peace as a guiding principle. All of them were opposing the Vietnam War. Kennedy was trying not to get it started. Robert Kennedy tried to end it. You know, Martin Luther King wanted to end it. Malcolm X wanted to end it. And, you know, we can easily point to racism in the case of two of them as a factor, but in reality, it wasn't. You know, all four of those were government-backed crimes, as far as my research goes. The CIA had tried to kill Malcolm X abroad. They tried to poison him. The CIA had a guy. He didn't work for the CIA at that time, but he did later. And that's in the famous picture of Martin Luther King after he was killed and he's lying there bleeding on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. There's his cohorts, the men with him, are all pointing up and to the right where they heard a shot. But the man who is not up and pointing and who is, like, you know, right over King's face, that guy now works for the CIA, Merrill McCullough. I find that very interesting. The guy at Robert Kennedy's right, when he was shot from behind and on the right, was a CIA contract agent, I found in my research. And, of course, with the John Kennedy assassination, the CIA is all over the Oswald story. They had files on him going back to the 50s. It's clear in my mind, after my research again, that he was sent to the Soviet Union, you know, to spy on them. And it looks like they might have even sent two people under his passport, you know, because once you have a passport and a guy, if you have two guys who look similar, you can use the same passport and get two in the country for the price of one. I mean, it's just amazing what goes on that we don't know about because we don't read about it and the news doesn't talk about it.
Right.
Lisa, I would like to add another name to that list of peace activists who were targeted, and that is the Trappist monk Thomas Merton, who was, I believe, assassinated in, I think it was Cambodia. They said he was electrocuted when a fan was thrown into his bathtub as he was sitting in it. He was clearly he was clearly organizing the Catholic workers movement, and was forming partnerships with Martin Luther King and others, really to really activate the peace movement in the beginning stages of the Vietnam War. Do you think Thomas Merton was a target as well?
I do, and I haven't looked into that one, so I don't pretend to know it as a fact, but I have long believed that from what I've read, based especially on what you talked about. It's, again, it's that pattern of peacemaker. I'll add one more for sure, and that's Dag Hammarskjöld. He was the UN secretary at the time. He was trying to keep the CIA and the Belgians and the UK from stealing the wealth of Congo, which is the site of rare earth minerals. And so, you know, an international consortium was trying to sponsor a terrorist group, essentially, to break off the Katanga province where all the minerals were and leave the rest of the poor, you know, mineral-free, you know, part of Congo to Lumumba and his team. And Dag Hammarskjöld fought to keep it unified. And then, of course, Lumumba was killed. There's a famous photo of John Kennedy, President John Kennedy, because he was killed before Kennedy was inaugurated. And there's a picture of him at the desk, you know, during the transition with this look of agony on his face. The photographer caught him right at the moment he got the news of Lumumba's death. Right. So there's a high price when you try and do something to save the rest of the world. And God bless each and every one of them for doing what they did and for being willing to risk their lives. I mean, both Kennedys were quite certain what they were doing might get them killed. They had no illusions, and they did it anyway. And I just find that incredible and uplifting and astonishing. And same with Martin Luther King, the last speech of his life, he's like, I may not get there with you. Right. And Malcolm X, too. They all knew that they were marked for assassination. Dag Hammarskjöld, they all knew, and they did it anyway. So these are people who, at the very least, to respect their sacrifice, we owe it to them and the world to find out who really killed them.
Right.
Lisa, let's get back to Bobby Kennedy. before we get into the three known CIA operatives that were in the ballroom at the Ambassador Hotel, chief among them, David Sanchez Morales, who was the inspiration, if
well,
you want to call
hold
it that.
On. Before you go down that road, because even Shane O'Sullivan, who wrote that, backed off of that. That part of the story has been fairly well discredited.
Oh, okay.
I'm like,
okay.
There were known CIA operatives there, but not that group.
Okay.
Right.
All right. So frame for our audience, if you will, what the cover story was on the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, the official story was, and then what forensic evidence did not add up.
Right. Okay. Official story. Bobby Kennedy had just won the California primary, gives his speech in the embassy ballroom, walks through a narrow little pantry en route to the print media that he was about to talk to. And a young Palestinian immigrant who was obsessed with Kennedy. This is the official story. This is not the real story. This is the official story. A young Palestinian immigrant was obsessed with Kennedy's approval of bombers to Israel and pulled out a gun and fired and killed not only him, but wounded five other people in the pantry at the same time. All right, that's kind of the official story. All right, but the problem with that is everything. It's like, first of all, there was no single assassin. You know, Kennedy was shot in a way from multiple positions. I talk about that more in my book, and we won't have time to get into that there. But for sure, Kennedy was shot from behind as Sirhan by all witness accounts who saw them both. All of them uniformly put Sirhan and Robert Kennedy facing each other. Robert Kennedy put his hands up to his face because he too saw Sirhan with a gun out. So, you know, it made sense that he wanted to protect his face, you know, put his hands up. That's what people do if you perceive a threat from the front. And yet Robert was shot from behind the right ear at a distance of about an inch, and then three times in the back right armpit area.
Right.
So a little behind the armpit. One of the shots only went through his clothing, one went through his body, and then one lodged at the base of his neck from that area. And then in the headshot, there's at least one gunshot that has two tracks, so we could assume it's split in half or whatever. But again, Sirhan was in front, and he was about 3 feet away. All of the shots in Kennedy were like from a distance of about an inch. So somebody was standing next to Robert Kennedy while Sirhan was firing at him. And then there's the problem of there's just way too many bullets. I'm sorry, do you want to ask a question?
The CIA person right next to his right. Is it your opinion, and we'll just say that, is it your opinion that the CIA took him out?
Absolutely. And the guy to his right was a guard who did work most of his life as a contract agent for the CIA. At the time of the assassin, he was working for Robert Mayhew, who is one of the CIA's, they call them cutouts because they don't like work out of Langley. They work in the field, you know. But he was under contract with the CIA himself. He was working for Howard Hughes at the time. Howard Hughes hired him because he wanted to get in bed with the CIA. And Hughes had the money, so the CIA loved it. And Hughes had the kind of right-wing attitude that the CIA also loved. You know, they agreed on who should go and who should not. I don't think Hughes was behind the killing of Robert Kennedy, but I don't know either way. But it's clear the CIA was involved, and there's hints that certain people in the CIA knew. James Angleton somehow got a hold of the autopsy photographs of Robert Kennedy. But it's just stunning that, you know, again, here's this guard, Thane Caesar, who has described himself as a CIA contract agent, all, you know, in public documents. These are bank records, loans. You know, he owns a couple of homes. You have to put your employer down. And that's what he's been putting in his public records. So, you know, it's hard not to see the CIA behind all four of these. And then when you get to what happened when the police come in and they see literally all these holes in the pantry, according to the police photographer, not only was Kennedy shot four times and five other people wounded with an eight-shot gun, supposedly. That's nine bullets from an eight-shot gun, right? So some of the bullets had to go in and out of people. But then there were holes in the door frames, and I actually have video of two of the bullet holes. I saw this at UCLA one day, and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe this even exists. I can't believe I've never seen this in a documentary. And I called Jim DiEugenio, a good friend and, you know, collaborator from Probe Magazine. At that point, he lived an hour away. I'm like, Jim, I can't go home till you come and see this and witness this, because I'm so afraid if I walk out of here, people will figure out what it is. It'll disappear from evidence, because that happens all the time. Good files suddenly disappear from evidence. We found Alan Dulles's calendar at, Alan Dulles was the head of the CIA in the 60s, and we found it at the Princeton Library. A researcher gave me a heads up that his personal papers were there. I found the calendar. David Talbot was writing his book about Alan Dulles at the time, The Devil's Chessboard. And so I took some screenshots and I sent them to David to use in his book, because on 11/22 and for several days thereafter, his calendar just said the farm. And Alan Dulles is not a country boy. And the farm is the name of the CIA's Camp Peary facility where they train the young recruits. And so it looked like Alan Dulles was hunkering down in a bunker at CIA, even though he had been expelled by Kennedy, been fired by Kennedy. But there he was back at the CIA, I assume, troubleshooting the cover story afterwards.
So you mentioned the CIA is all over
that
this.
That disappeared is my point. Sorry.
Right. Excuse me for speaking over you. We have a bit of a delay. The CIA is all over this. What was the relationship between the CIA and local LAPD authorities and those
Great
in charge?
Question. Great question. They were very close. They had actually done joint operations. They did one where they tried, they made a porno flick, pretending it was the Indonesian president Sukarno and pairing him with a blonde that he was seen with, a lookalike that they in the film made out to be some Soviet agent who was taking advantage of him. I mean, the CIA and the LAPD had been very close for years. Mayhew especially, Mayhew was involved in that particular operation. So he was deep in there. And then the two guys who ran the conspiracy angle of the investigation of Special Unit Senator, which the LAPD set up to investigate the crime and staffed entirely with people with intelligence backgrounds. And then Manny Pena had worked for the CIA. His brother said he was very proud of his service to the CIA. I learned recently his son said his father was a CIA assassin. Now that I don't know. I don't know where his son got that, because I have not seen that. But he definitely was a CIA contract agent, if you will. And same with Hank Hernandez, who worked closely with Pena. Hank Hernandez was the guy who got to say whether a witness was telling the truth or not, because he put them all on a, lie detector, which are, by the way, not allowed in court. And after reading his transcripts, I can see why. You know, you can scare people into saying something that isn't true and then call them a liar, or you can just make them so nervous that even when they're telling the truth, it can read like a lie. And as the lie detector operator, you can also, the polygraph operator, you can also just wave away somebody and pretend that they're just nervous when they're actually lying. And Hernandez did all of those. It's like he scared some witnesses into saying things that weren't true. He got Sandy Serrano, who was not afraid, but at that point she was very tired. It was like 10 p.m. at night. He had taken her and her aunt out for a steak dinner and given her wine, even though I'm pretty sure she was still underage at the time. She was 20 and the law then was 21. And so he kind of plied her with alcohol, and then he separated her from her aunt. And the whole reason she brought the aunt is she didn't want to talk to the police alone. He made the aunt go outside, put her on a lie detector, and then they had a two-hour session that was just horrific. You can only call it psychological torture. So in the end, Sandy realized she was never leaving that room until she gave them what she wanted. So she finally said, maybe I'm, misunderstood. Maybe I didn't see it. Sandy had seen and heard a woman in a polka dot dress with a man in a gold sweater that she had seen 20 minutes before the assassination. She saw a girl in a polka dot dress, a guy in a gold sweater, and Sirhan go up the back stairs and into the embassy ballroom through the fire escape. All right. And then after the assassination, a few seconds later, you know, the girl and the guy in the gold sweater came running out the back. But the guy who was Sirhan, she didn't know it was Sirhan at the time. But, you know, later when she saw pictures, she's like, that's the guy that was with them going in and not with them coming back out. And as they flew out the back, the girl was saying, we shot him, we shot him. Sandy said, who did you shoot? And the girl said, we shot Robert Kennedy, or we shot Senator Kennedy. And so she was very consistent on that story until, like I said, until 10 p.m. at night with some wine in her and strapped to a machine with a guy berating her and saying, you know, Sandy, you know, you don't want to do this. You don't want to say this to the Kennedys. Your children someday, you know, will never forgive you. I mean, it was just horrible, the session. There's audio of that online. People can find it and listen to it. I quoted a lot of it in my book because once you understand their techniques, then you realize they did that to everyone. Because I did. Right. I read the other transcripts. They're all bad. Sandy wasn't actually singled out. He did that to anyone who had evidence of conspiracy. Most of them caved a lot sooner. She's the only one who hung in there as long as she did.
Two questions, if I may. Sirhan acted in the days following his arrest very robotically, and in fact, he claims he has no memory of the night that Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. What, yes, if any connection did you find between Sirhan and the CIA's MK Ultra project? That's my first question. And my second question is, during the parole hearing, why wasn't any of this forensic evidence offered up? Why didn't they make the parole hearing the venue for finally getting to the truth?
Okay, I'll answer the second part first, is that a parole hearing is not a trial and will not accept that evidence, and they would literally shut off their mic and move on. So there's no point. So I get that. They did apply to have an evidentiary hearing, and Kamala Harris, our vice president, denied that request. And wow. Her response was written by a guy named Mel Eitan, who is kind of the Gerald Posner of the Robert F. Kennedy case, people who don't tell the truth, even though it's right there in front of them. Okay. But the question about hypnosis is key, because Sirhan has no memory of what happened, and the police accepted that. The prosecution and his defense team all recognized his memory loss was real. It was not due to a lie. It was not due to brain damage. He had an absolute, he's still to this day. In fact, I talked to his brother, Munir, and Munir said, Lisa, you know, when my mother and him went to see him in jail, as soon as we realized he was the guy in jail, he said that was the very first thing. You know, his mother said, what happened? He's like, I don't remember. I mean, and Sirhan always was very honest with his mother. They were extremely close. If he would have told anybody what happened, it would have been his mother. He literally didn't remember. And this is common under hypnosis. Now, the subject of hypnosis has been misrepresented throughout history for good reason. It's very powerful. And so we are always told, oh, you can't make somebody do something under hypnosis they don't natively want to do. And that's both literally true and a lie. If I told you, take off your clothes under hypnosis, you probably wouldn't. But if I, you know, set a scenario, it's like now you're on a camel and you're in the desert and it's super hot and, you know, you're getting parched and, oh, my God, the sun is beating down so much and these clothes are just weighing you down. And if you take off your shirt, you're going to feel so much better. You know, then I could probably get you to take off your shirt, you know, you have to be a skilled hypnotist. But so in the case with Sirhan, there's a program called Project Artichoke. This came before MK Ultra, because actually Sirhan doesn't link to MK Ultra, but the scenario in Project Artichoke, CI posed the question: can a person of blank, you know, redacted nationality be induced to commit an act of attempted assassination as part of a larger project? And that's pretty much exactly the point. Sirhan was not firing bullets. Sirhan was firing blanks. And he did it because he was programmed to shoot at targets on the range. He'd actually been to a range all day and had been firing at targets, but somewhere along the way he had been programmed, and there's like a whole year where it seems like he was being programmed. He went to the doctor 13 times for something the doctor said was totally mild, and I'm like, then why was he there 13 times?
Right.
And at the pinch of from this girl in the polka dot dress, Sirhan went into what they call his later day hypnotist called range mode. Dan Brown is one of the hypnotic experts in the country. He examined Sirhan for 60 hours. His initial defense team had tried to hypnotize Sirhan to get him to remember. That was actually really common in the 60s, to use hypnosis to recover memories. And they weren't able to get Sirhan to remember anything. And his defense lawyer tried. He's like, Sirhan, reach for the gun. There's Robert Kennedy. You know, shoot at him. Do you remember that? You know, he was almost like trying to give him a memory of that. And it didn't work. But Dan Brown asked him open-ended questions. Where were you? What did you hear? What did you see? And in that scenario, he realized that the last thing Sirhan remembers is the girl pinching him, and then he thought he was back at the firing range. He pulled out his gun and he fired. If he had had bullets in them, all right, Robert Kennedy would have been shot in the chest or in the head or in the face, not from behind.
So we have about 5 minutes left.
He had a fairly clear shot. His first shot, no one really expected it. So
we have about 5 minutes left with you, Lisa. And if Sirhan was not the assassin, could you name the team members who were?
Only Thane Eugene Caesar was clearly involved. He was the guard at the right who worked for Mayhew and was a contract agent for the CIA. And he was a big, burly man who was literally holding Kennedy's right elbow with his left hand. And he was himself right-handed. So he was in the perfect position to shoot Kennedy under the arm where the bullets were without anybody being able to see him do it. There were witnesses who saw him with a gun out. One even said it was smoking, like it had just been fired. And witness did say originally that the guard fired and hit Robert Kennedy. But then he was confused, and later he's like, well, I'm not sure what I saw or whatever. Right. But he said, I know the guard fired his gun. And
Lisa,
so
we have a caller.
Really,
we have a caller. Pardon. Caller, if you're listening, go ahead with your question.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Ms. Heath, for this very important show and for documenting the miscarriages of justice in the anti-peace movement. I wanted to ask you, though, about the human dimensions of the parole board decisions for Sirhan, because originally last summer they recommended releasing him. And
given
all of the uncertainty, even if it's not that accepted by the family, I'm just wondering, what about the human dimensions in this kind of parole case that really calls for Sirhan's release? How would you tackle that? And perhaps, because I think that he's got yet one more injustice against him if he's, you know, by being kept in prison.
Right. There was a misstatement at the start of the show. Sirhan was paroled. It was the governor who vetoed the parole. And Sirhan, first of all, our governor should not have that power. We're one of only four states where the governor even has that power. So that's problem number one. And two, Sirhan, he's 77 years old. He is a kind man. He is not violent. He has never really been violent, even though, you know, I mean, if you understand the facts of the case, he's never been violent. But even if you believe the official story, people do reform. And the California passed a law because your brain chemistry literally changes around age 26. And so they made a new law where anybody who was younger than 26 should be strongly considered for parole. And Sirhan was 24 at the time. So even if you believe the official story, that's 50 years in prison, you know, more than 50 years for him to learn morality and grow up and mature and, you know, get the brain in order. And he's taken every class they've thrown at him, anger management, alcohol management, whatever. He's taken it and he's passed with flying colors.
Lisa, we have another call for you. Caller, if you're ready, go ahead with your question.
Hi, yeah, this is Jeff Wright on the Mendocino Coast. And I've always been disturbed by the three assassinations. I was six when JFK was killed, and in sixth grade, 11 years old, when Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy were killed. I've always been bothered that they never really go into very deeply the RFK assassination, and June 6th always just seems to wander by, whereas the other two assassination dates are paid a lot more attention to. And the Ambassador Hotel has been destroyed, so you can't go like you can to Dallas and look at the scene of the crime. I've always felt like L.A. has kind of just tried to completely brush this under the rug. And that, along with the assassinations of the President and Vice President of Vietnam 2 weeks before JFK, and Marilyn Monroe being killed by a barbiturate enema by mobsters and people that were seen
involved in that whole cover-up. No, I believe that to be false. Cover-up. From my research,
I'm wondering,
so
I know you can't answer all these,
Marilyn
but is
Monroe
this in your
was
book, and is it addressed
she
in
died
there?
Of an accidental
and with trafficking
overdose.
In the storm drain killing our JFK? So many questions. So little time. I hope it's in your book. Please give us the title, and thank you for your work. I really
thank you, Jeff.
It.
The title of the book is A Lie Too Big to Fail. Lisa, we want to get your contact information, and we will note that you don't feel that Marilyn Monroe was killed, that it was an accidental overdose. I don't think Jeff heard that. What contact information do we have for you?
You can find me on Twitter, at Lisa Pease, P-E-A-S-E. You can look for me on Facebook, although I don't usually friend people I don't know. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't.
Right.
But, yeah, the best place to find me is I'm usually on Twitter every day, so if I have something important to say, I usually say it there.
And your book, Too Big to Fail, The Real History of the Assassination.
You can find that at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any independent bookseller. If you have a favorite bookstore, go there. They can order it for you. So please support the independent bookstores, yes.
Lisa Pease.
It's also, by the way, on audio and Kindle as well.
Lisa Pease, thank you for being with us today. It's really an interesting and provoking book and idea that this was all not as we were told. Thank you for joining us. We're going to take a brief pause and welcome our next guest. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to KMUD, Garberville, 91.1 FM. I want to remind our listeners that the views and opinions expressed throughout the broadcast day are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the station, its staff, or underwriters. Time will be made available for other viewpoints. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Dennis. We're going to go on with our second half of the program. It's 32 minutes past the hour, and we've been speaking about the recent denial of parole of Sirhan Sirhan, the assassination of RFK, and all things that don't add up. And our next guest is Denise F. Bodden. Excuse me if I'm mispronouncing that. She is a lawyer and filmmaker and the daughter of Fernando Farah, one of the first investigative journalists to examine RFK's killing. She has continued much of her father's work and has helped set up the website justiceforrfk.com, which has a detailed breakdown of different aspects of the case. Ms. Bodden co-wrote the piece, A Response to Kerry and Chris Kennedy's Statements about Sirhan Sirhan's Parole Recommendation. So without further ado, I know Denise is on hold, so let's go ahead and get into the program. Denise, are you with us?
Hi, I am. Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
Welcome to the program. Well, first of all, I'm curious to know if you found anything different with respect to the killings and the cover-up from your father, Fernando Farah. Did you learn anything differently, or have you uncovered new things?
Well, I would say that I by and large, agree with Lisa's analysis of the situation.
Uh-huh.
There's a handful of very esteemed researchers, and there are little differences among us about a detail here and there, but I would say that by and large, we all are very clear that there was something more involved than a lone gunman. Most of the researchers, including myself, believe that the person who killed Robert Kennedy was Dame Eugene Caesar, who was standing behind him, that Lisa discussed. And then what I've really done, it's important to understand, my dad's lane was fairly narrow at the time. He picked up on one thread of the investigation, and mm-hmm. that was Sandy Serrano saying that she saw a woman running in a polka-dot dress. So my father, who was, you know, in his early 30s, had four young kids. He worked for the Hollywood Citizen News, which was like the second most circulated paper in L.A. at the time, decided that, you know, he really wanted to track down this lead because clearly, obviously, if there's somebody running away saying, we shot him, right. then that means that there was more than one person involved in this killing. So he wrote a book, which is called The Polka Dot File, which really just goes through a day-by-day account of what he was doing to pursue this lead. And what became obvious to him pretty quickly was that the FBI and the LAPD and whoever else was working the strings behind the scenes were not all that interested in finding out the truth and assisting with finding other witnesses. They were really sort of trying to shut him down, intimidate him, discredit him, harass the witnesses that he did find, and he pretty quickly realized there was a much bigger story going on. Mm-hmm. What I did was, as a filmmaker, I'd done a couple of documentaries, and I was, you know, as my dad was ending, you know, nearing the end of his life, I thought I should do a documentary about my dad's work. And I really honestly did not know very much about the details of this case until about 4 years ago when I started doing a film about my dad. And I just wanted to document his sort of slice of his historical role in this incredible piece of American history. But as a lawyer, once I started learning things and reading all the books, you know, Lisa's book and Shane's book and all the books going back to, you know, as early as almost immediately after the crime, and watching some of the documentaries that were done by Ted Chirac, and I realized, you know, the evidence doesn't add up and I don't like this. I don't like it at all as a lawyer. And I became, I would say, as many of us are, a little bit obsessed with getting justice, you know, for Sirhan, of course, because he's so been so abused by the criminal system and the broader conspiracy that occurred, but also because I feel like the American people are just being ripped off to be lied to in such a egregious way. And also the Kennedy family. As much as I'm, you know, speaking out against some of the members of the Kennedy family that are opposed to parole, I really am trying to resolve this case or help push it forward because I believe that Robert Kennedy himself and the Kennedy family deserve to know what really happened.
Yeah, it's. I'll tell you what's egregious. It's egregious that the top law enforcement officer in the country, the Attorney General of the United States, is murdered and someone is framed for that murder and justice is never meted out. That is what is truly outrageous.
It is. And when you look at, you know, Lisa talked a little bit about the CIA and the LAPD. I mean, just to give you an idea what it was like, my dad was on the beat at that time, on this reporting beat. It was common knowledge that the LAPD and the CIA were housed in the same building on different floors. I mean, the sieve that was flowing between them, it's not something that we have today. We have so much scrutiny. It still happens, but it's just better hid. Back in those days, it really wasn't. And the fact that they put two CIA operatives, known, documented CIA people, to run this investigation, and then we have the evidence that Lisa alluded to, about Hank Hernandez basically browbeating every witness that had anything to say that may have led to an opposite conclusion of what they were feeding people. It's Denise, really horrible.
Denise, a lot of the things that don't add up in the investigation, a lot of the forensic evidence, the multiple bullet counts, the autopsies, et cetera, that would have come out in a trial. Why wasn't there a trial?
Well, there was, quote unquote, a trial. But what happened was there was an agreement, a stipulation before the trial began by Grant Cooper, who was the attorney for Sirhan and the district attorney, and of course the judge approved it. And that agreement was that they would not contest his culpability. They took a position that basically everybody knows he shot him. There's a ton of witnesses to it. So what we're going to do is we're going to try to save his life instead, because the death penalty was active then. And what we're going to do is we're going to do basically a sentencing hearing, and we're going to try to show that, you know, there's mitigating factors, you know, he really wasn't of his right mind, and we're going to try to save this 24-year-old's life. Now, that would never happen now. I don't think it should have happened then. They did not even see the autopsy until after that agreement was made. So imagine a criminal trial now where you don't even look at all the evidence first. Right. Before you make a plea of guilty. It's outrageous. Right. So he had a trial, but it was really more geared towards should we put him to death or not. And so it wasn't, a lot of things were not challenged. When you read, as an attorney, when you read the record of that trial, you have to literally get up from your chair and walk away, because it's so maddening what the defense did to actually help get him prosecuted.
Like such as?
Well, such as there were the most egregious chain of custody for both the gun and the bullets that were presented at trial. So the prosecution would present a bullet and say, these are the bullets that came from the victim. And the defense would say, so stipulated, rather than have any kind of chain of custody that would demonstrate that that actual bullet really did come from the victim, and that it's, you know, prior to that came from the gun. And what happened was, this occurred throughout the trial. You know, the whatever you could call it. It's hard for me to even call it a trial, but this occurred throughout it, the proceedings. And what we learned later, once the records were released, and keep in mind, all the records were not available to the public until one of the victims, Paul Schrade, and one of Kennedy's friends, Allard Lowenstein, pushed and pushed and pushed through the court system to get records released. So it wasn't until really the 80s when a lot of this stuff came out. Now we get to look at chains of custody, documents from the LAPD file. Hey, let's look at, you know, where was that gun from the moment it was taken out of Sirhan's hand? And where were those bullets? And who did the test firing? And what, lo and behold, what we found was a corrupt criminalist who ran the whole criminalist and bullet, basically the ballistics evidence. We found out that he lied. He lied to the jury. He said he took out a second gun, a gun that had nothing to do with the crime. It was from a different crime. And he ran testing on that, and he took those test bullets and informed probably the grand jury, but most definitely the jury at the trial, that the bullets were Sirhan's bullets, when in fact they weren't. They were from an entirely different gun that he pulled out of an evidence locker from a previous crime. So that, you know, at a careful trial, that never would have happened. You would have had a defense attorney that demonstrates those bullets didn't come from Sirhan's gun, and these bullets don't match the victim bullets. So there were so many problems with the evidence and the chains of custody that, you know, really, if somebody took the time to look at it again, it would fail. And I want to add here, there was immediate clamoring that there were problems with how this case was investigated and prosecuted. And because of that, there was it's commonly known as the Wenke court. Judge Wenke ordered a panel of ballistic experts to sort of review it because of all this clamoring. And what they found corroborated what all the researchers are saying. They found that Wolfer had mixed up the bullets. They found they were not able to match any of the bullets to Sirhan's gun. It's often said by people who want to go with the lone gun theory, that they, quote-unquote, found no evidence of a second gun, but that's actually not accurate. What they found was they couldn't rule out that there was a second gun, but they didn't find affirmative evidence that there was.
Right.
And there's a very, it's a subtle verbal difference, but it's a huge difference.
Right, right.
Exactly. So that's kind of where we are, and I started doing my thing and working on the case, and yes, I have found a couple of leads pursuing the polka dot girl. I have, in the film, when it is released, you will see members of her family talking about what they knew at the time when they were children. They were very aware that their mother and father were up to something, but they were kids. They didn't know what it was. And as they slowly grew to learn who their parents were, the polka dot girl's husband is, we have found, was a CIA operative. And wow. He worked in the brainwashing or mind control field for the CIA. And so what I'm pursuing is along that channel at this time, and a few other things that I'm working on that have not yet, you know, fully fleshed out yet, so I'd be remiss to speak about it.
Right. No, I understand.
What remedies, if any, does Sirhan Sirhan have left?
Sure.
Lisa talked about an evidentiary hearing that Kamala Harris denied Sirhan Sirhan when Kamala Harris was Attorney General of the state of California. There any way to reopen this case?
Well, first of all, Kamala Harris was the AG at the time, right? So what she did was her office wrote the objection to Sirhan's petition. So the U.S. District Court, the Central District, is really the one who did the denying. But Kamala Harris took a position, having reviewed it all, and she took a position against opening up the case or letting him have a new trial. And then ultimately the U.S. District Court for the Central District agreed. They said, we're not allowing this to go forward. So it never got to a full fleshed out hearing. And I think it's very important to say that Governor Newsom, in his recent pronouncements, and the Kennedy family are quick to always say that Sirhan has had his second and third and fourth and fifth day in court because the district court, you know, heard his petition and denied it. It's critical to note, his petition was a request to bring forth evidence in a forum. It was denied. Mm-hmm. That means he did not get to bring forth the evidence in a forum.
Right.
And it gets very nuanced with the law here, but I can tell you in shorthand, he would have had to show actual innocence to that Ninth District for them to allow him to have a trial. Obviously, you can't do that in paper. You know, you can allege
right.
certain things, and you really need to have the trial and the experts, and, for example, the hypnosis expert, Dr. Brown, testify. And so it's really not accurate to say that he got his second bite of the apple. He never did.
Are these habeas corpus petitions?
They are, and they have very, very narrow exceptions that you have to fit, and if you don't plug into those, you're not going to make it. And, of course, what he really wants to do, and what would be fair, is to get to a hearing where he can present his evidence, and the question is, would a jury of his peers have had reasonable doubt, right? That's what he was really entitled to, like all defendants are. And he's trying to get to that hearing. He's been denied at every stage to even bring forth that evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So, regards to the parole, though, what happened on August 27th of last year, the parole board does is they recommend parole. They recommend it. And it goes through different layers. So I was at the parole board hearing, and Lisa's 100% correct. It's a very narrow review. They don't look at the original crime except in certain nuances, but they assume the crime and the conviction is correct and it happened. And then they just look at, you know, the obvious things. How has he done in jail? How's his behavior been? How long has he been in jail? In prison. And then, of course, the youthful offender statute that is now in place, and then also the elderly inmate
right.
statute. So they look at all those things, and there was zero question that Sirhan fits squarely 100% in all of those categories. So what they then did was it goes to the Fuller panel, and the entire board reviews it. I believe, don't quote me, but it's close to 20 people. They have to approve what the two-panel board did, and in this case, they did. They looked at it. They said, this gentleman is eligible for parole, and not only is he eligible, we recommend it. We believe he's not a danger to society.
Right.
Then it goes to the government.
Okay. 49 minutes past the hour. We have about 8 or so minutes left with you, Denise. Denise, are you, as someone who's investigating the truth and making documentary films, and you have a law background, are you in any way worried about what you're uncovering, or you're exploring this idea from anyone nefarious?
There's been some odd moments, but no, I'm not worried. You know, when I was a kid, I had distinct memories of us being followed. I know there were people that were really harassing my dad. I haven't run into any trouble. I think, you know, enough time has passed, although, you know, I'm cautious. You know, I'm careful about what I do. You know, who knows? I might turn over a stone and all of a sudden everything could change, because I truly believe that still a lot of people exist that don't want this out. I do want to say one quick thing, though, on the parole issue. I am a strong advocate that the governor, who's a political elected official, should not have decision-making authority over parole decisions.
Right.
I think it politicizes the whole process, and it's a real problem. And that's really demonstrated in what happened in this case. And quickly, yes, there is a legal avenue. We are now petitioning the Superior Court, which oversees the governor's decision. And then, of course, depending on that outcome, he still has full appellate review all the way up.
Well, there looks like there's a process for Sirhan to perhaps be paroled. But what about reinvestigating this whole crime, given the new evidence that you and Lisa and others have uncovered? Right. What is the process, or is there a process, and what pushback do you think there might be?
Well, the real process at this point, if we found, you know, quote unquote, the smoking gun, there's always the opportunity, if there's some substantial new evidence, to bring that forth and petition the court. But I continue to believe, and those that are like-minded, that continuing to get the word out like we're doing today on this show, and writing books and putting out my documentary, and getting the public to understand that they've been duped.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically, if they did it then, they can do it now. That's the real issue. People might think, oh, this is old, who cares? Well, if they did that and they get away with it, that's a lot of hubris. They're going to do it again. And they probably are doing it again. And so I feel like the real avenue is to make people aware, and then we can have, you know, a louder voice that demands justice for people that are in this situation, and certainly for Sirhan.
What do you say to people that don't believe our government or the CIA, FBI, what have you, would not do such a thing? What do you say to people? Because there's such clear evidence, and we've had several shows about government conspiracy and the shadow government. How do you address that to people?
You know, I think that with people like that, I try not to judge them. I try to point them to things that are empirically, you know, that they can read themselves, that are straight from the government, that are admissions of their wrongdoing. So with particular in this case, I say, let me send you the congressional hearings on MK Ultra. Read it yourself. This is what the government did. It's open documents. You can see how they did these clandestine tests. You can see how unethical they were. You can see how they had experimentation on people that didn't even know they were being given drugs and hypnosis. And and judge for yourself what our government is capable of. What about the Tuskegee experiments? What about that? That's a common one everybody knows about. It was egregious. It was a cover-up. It was done. So,
I try to
point them to things that are historically already proven, so they can say, oh, yeah, I guess, you know, this does happen.
It seems that Americans just want to embrace, I mean, culturally speaking, want to embrace willful ignorance. when it comes to the assassination of our president, Kennedy, his brother, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Thomas Merton, all clearly peace activists who, in my opinion, were killed by pro-war interest when the peace movement was just getting off the ground. President Kennedy actually warned against this in a speech in the year of his death in April at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel to the American Society of Newspaper Publishers. He explicitly told of a secret government, a government that he could not control. This is explicit. This you can pull this up on YouTube. He warned of this, but no, we didn't believe him then, and we don't believe him now. Why?
I think that it's more difficult to have this kind of knowledge. It's easier to just ignore it. And frankly, you know, people have their lives and they're busy doing what they're doing. And if it doesn't affect them, they really don't have time for it or bandwidth for it. And, you know, granted, there's a lot going on in the world. You can only pick your own battles, right? But right. I think what they're missing out on is if we start really addressing these things and confronting them dead on and not just sticking our head in the sand, then that's the sooner we'll be out of these kinds of messes. And we can eliminate some of this, and life will be better. But I think it's just it's too difficult. It's harder to do the work and look at these things and admit when there's corruption in your own house, you know?
Yeah. Denise, we have a caller for you. Caller, if you're listening, please go ahead with your brief question. We just have a few minutes.
Yeah, I'll be brief this time. This is Jeff. Do you think that L.A. and the CIA have tried to cover up the RFK assassination in ways that, such as you can go to Dealey Plaza, but the Ambassador Hotel has been completely demolished, and you can't go and see these scenes of the crime? And will your film be submitted to the Mendocino Film Festival? I would love to see it. If not, where is it available? Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you for your question. My film is not done yet, and I'm not sure where it'll end up being distributed, but of course I'll try to get it as broad and wide as possible. In regards to the Ambassador Hotel, I have to say I really am not the expert to speak on what happened with the demolition of that. However, I do know that the one thing I do know about it is that Paul Schrade, who was a good friend of Robert Kennedy, and who was also a victim that night. He was the gentleman that was shot first in the head, who advocates for Sirhan's parole. He was a huge advocate in taking that Ambassador Hotel and turning it into the school that it is in the name of Robert Kennedy. So I don't know about the machinations behind it, if there was anything, that was purposefully, for example, destroyed or covered up with regards to that. I wouldn't be the person that could effectively answer that. I know there were a lot of very sincere advocates and true friends of Robert Kennedy that wanted that school to be put there in his honor, and that they considered that one of their great legacies.
Very good.
Right. It should have been a historical site in my view, but thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Denise, we need to say goodbye to you. We're out of time. Thank you so much, and I hope you will update us so that we can know when your film is completed, and also want to refer folks to your justiceforrfk.com, which is you helped set that up. So thank you for being our guest.
Thank you for your fierce, fierce pursuit of justice.
Thank you very much.
For such an important man from such an important family. Thank you for just honoring your own father in your work. I want to thank KMUD for this platform as well. Only on this station do you get programs like this with guests like this in the pursuit of justice for national heroes. Please support KMUD by becoming a member. Become part of this family that supports programs like these on subjects like these with guests like these. Thank you.
This has been Heroes and Patriots. John and I will return to the air on March 3rd and March 31st with guests. On the 3rd, we have Norman Solomon and Madeline Hirsch.
Yes, correct.
Am I correct? So please join us at that time, same time, first and fifth Thursday of each month at from 9 to 10 a.m. live right here on KMUD Community Radio.
Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support of KMUD by becoming a member.
Your sedans and your bushes, your bin Ladens and snakes, you billionaire bullies, you're a globalized curse. You put war on the masses, and then you clean out the purse. And that's how it's done. War after war, you old feudal parasites, you just sacrifice the poor. You got the cutting-edge weapons.